Accession number 31393, Reel 3.
John Pemberton, Reel 3. John, can you describe how the pattern of your operations changed? Because you were operating with a sort of a number of years, weren't you?
So, can you
give me a kind of outline of how the pattern of your operations changed from 41 onwards?
Well, I think the pattern has changed because of the new procedures. As I told you at the beginning, at first you try to chase an aeroplane close up to it and shoot it down. But then with the speeds being virtually equal, our speeds and German speeds, that wasn't a very successful thing. So they developed the interception of aircraft from a different angle, which made it more difficult for the operator because you had to be really precise. If you missed it, then you missed it. Sitting behind an aeroplane which is in front of you, I don't think you're going to lose it very easy, but an aircraft which is crossing you is very easy to lose. And the pattern also changed from the ground. They were more accurate, and they were more accurate in height, and they were able to get us up to much better proximity to the enemy aircraft. So that was the other thing. They also knew whether it was friendly or not. They had this information on the ground, which we did as well. And I think it became more sophisticated towards the end of the war because we had better equipment, which was more accurate. And then the fighter command decided they would use us in bad weather during the day, and the fighter boys couldn't operate. But that would be mainly against attacking aircraft, not fighters.
How did the German pattern of operations change between 41 and 45?
Well, the Germans at the beginning were a little bit behind in night fighters, but due to the severity of the bombing, they soon picked up. And I remember I talked to a German night fighter pilot, and he told me about the lack of serviceability. You know, it wouldn't last very long, the equipment. And they had those rather clumsy aerials on the front, like we did on the Mark IV. But later, all the aerials were rotating aerials in the radar nose. So there was no external disturbance, which, of course, improved the speed of the aircraft. So there was a scanner in a sort of a snaky scan, and you could actually feel it. I think the German scored up, and when I read some of the German aces, how many aircraft they shot down, but of course I realized the bomber streams over Germany were severe, and the heaviest boxes, didn't they? They had a system of boxes where they put a knife fighter in each box. And they were quite successful. And a lot of our aircraft were really shot down by night fighters.
What about how the German bombers operated against the UK? Did that change while you were operating as a night fighter?
Well, it got less and less, you see. with the heavy bombing, and then, of course, the Russian front, because they were fighting in Russia, the raids got comparatively reduced. And after the main blitz of all the big towns, we were then encouraged to do intruder patrols into Germany. But they took the radar off. We were doing purely intruder patrols, low level, shooting up trains and barges and anything that they said, anything that moved. But that was short-lived because we lost quite a few crews on that. And they decided, then when the doodlebugs, the flying bomb, the V-1 started, we had, of course, mosquitoes. They thought perhaps we stand a good chance of doing something against that. It was difficult. But we were always told, if you want to shoot a flying bomb down, if you really want to fire at it, you've got to fire at it when it's dead ahead, because it'll blow up and you might be lucky to fly through, no debris at all. And some of them were tipping them over and so on.
So am I right in thinking the pattern with yourself, you had a very early period where you were going against large German bomber streams?
Yes.
In 42 and 43?
Three. Heavy bombing, it was heavy bombing. But from 43 to 44, it was a small raids, more or less nuisance raids, to keep us occupied so they wouldn't be able to use us somewhere else. It was more and more difficult to really to intercept the bomber. But they were mainly fast Messerschmitt 410s, flying in groups of perhaps 20, 30, and intruders, trying to attack airfields and just a nuisance raid. So it was more difficult to obtain a target because the German activity has gradually diminished.
And was it 43 the period when you would also do the intruder?
Yes, in 43 we started, we did, they did put us on it, but they stopped us because they were worried that they were losing too many aircraft. To do an intruder at night at low level is not exactly easy. It's quite difficult. I know the dam busters did it, and they lost a hell of a lot of aircraft. But I think Fighter Command decided that it would be better to keep us as night fighters. And so we had fewer targets, but there were nuisance raids all the time. The Germans made sure that we would be occupied and not used somewhere else.
Because the low-level intruder raids sound very, very difficult to... I don't understand how that's almost possible.
Well, only in good... It was only in good bright nights. You could only do it in good bright nights and good weather. There was no way you could do it. You would have never seen anything. So if you saw a train, you would see a train, you would see a river, you would see something like that, or you would see some shipping off the Dutch coast. You could shoot up and things like that, minesweepers and so on. But it was short-lived. We actually lost our squad, our flight commander, Winward, and he was taken prisoner, but his navigator was killed. So then Fighter Command stopped it. And then there was this another flare of German activity with their faster bombers, those ME-410s. But that was not anywhere near on the level of the Blitz. That was just, to let the British know they can still produce a bombing raid. It was more difficult for the night fighters, since by that time a lot of the night fighters have been converted to different roles. But we stayed night fighters right until we were disbanded in 1945.
So was the difficulty by 44 almost the possible target?
It was difficult to find a target, yes, it was. And of course, The V-2 was no target at all. There was no defense against it. It was, but there was always the odd intruder or few aircraft. There might be sort of five or six aircraft approaching towards a city to disrupt the system. So there was I was actually chasing an aeroplane in 1945, I think it was in January. I think it was rather difficult. We intercepted it. We were at Church Fenton, I think, Church Fenton, I think. And, it might have been Petershead. No, it was Church Fenton, I think. And we got a visual on it. And it was such a bad weather, we couldn't make up our mind what it was. And I remember my pilot said to me, "What do we do?" I said, "Well, the war is won. I should hate to shoot down a mosquito." So we let it go. Then we learned there were about 14 Messerschmitt 410. They looked very much from behind. So that was one of the decisions. I don't regret it, actually.
One thing about operating at night, in the war, there was the myth put about eating carrots improving...
Yes, I heard about it, yes, of course.
Obviously as a cover for the use of radar. did any of the squadron members try to do anything to improve their night vision?
No. No. We were all tested for night vision before you were able to go to an eye fighter squadron. We had to go to a special eye center and you were tested for night vision. I think that was a propaganda release for the Germans. And people kept asking us in pubs and things, you know, we understand you can see at night and we understand you have to eat a lot of carrots. It wasn't true. It wasn't true. No, I don't think so. I know we laughed at it, and I think it was done purely as a propaganda gesture to fool the Germans, but none of us did anything to improve night vision.
Could there be anything that would affect your night vision?
Not to my knowledge. I asked the doctor several times. She said, it's very good for your eyes, generally speaking, if you eat a lot of vegetables. It's good for your eyes even now, if you want to, you know, keep your eyes... But we were never, ever told that we have to eat carrots or... It was a joke. It was a joke.
You told me off the tape as well a story about an aircraft that came to the squadron after it and what the commanding officer, Max Aitken, did with it. Could you repeat that story?
Yeah, well, we were presented by the city of Birmingham with a bullfighter, because they see we defended Birmingham. And it was delivered from the factory with a nice writing, the city of Birmingham. But unfortunately, it had a nasty accident and the crew lost their lives in the first week. And I think the mayor of Birmingham and all the dignitaries were coming to see. So Max Aitken very quickly had another bullfighter repainted all black and the lettering put on the city of Birmingham to, you know, to view it. And there are actually photographs in our squadron scrapbook where you can see the city of Birmingham aircraft, but it wasn't the one. But that was, we didn't want to disappoint them. They collected a lot of money. Bullfighters in those days cost £30,000. It was a fortune in those days.
And what about the squadron? Where did everybody come from?
Well, we were half and half, half British and half Czech. So one flight was British, one flight was Czech. They came from, some of them came from Bomber Command, who changed over to night fighters. One or two came from Fighter Command, who were on Spitfires. We had two navigators, two friends of mine, who did a tour on Wellingtons as rear air gunners and then converted to NAVRADs, navigator radio, as they called us, radio navigators. So there was a mixture. And some of them, like me, who was not on any other command except night fighters and on fighter command. So there was a mixture.
You were with the squadron for quite some time,
haven't you? I was with the squadron, apart from a short rest in between, from the beginning to the end. I had a short rest at headquarters at Stanmore, Bentley Priory, and then I went on a staff navigator's course at Shawbury, and then I went back to the squadron again. So I spent nearly all my war years with 68th Squadron, yes.
And how successful had the squadron been?
Very successful. I think we were rated as very successful. A lot of prints from the papers, you know, have survived in the squadron scrapbook. 17.5% of all German bombers have been destroyed by 68th Squadron or something like that. Yes, quite successful. I don't know offhand how many kills we had, but it's all recorded, and we were considered one of the successful squadrons.
And what happened to you as the war was going to end?
Well, when the war was coming towards the end, as there was nothing to do for us, the Fighter Command disbanded us in Church Fenton. We were disbanded, and we were all posted again to the Czech depot at Kosfet, and eventually we all gathered, all the Czech members of the Royal Air Force gathered at RAF Kosfet, and from there we went to RAF Bunston, taking our aircraft with us, Spitfires. The day boys took the Spitfires, then the bomber boys took Liberators, they were on coastal command, and we took some mosquitoes. And from Munston, we all flew so-called victory flight to Prague in August, I think. They kept us waiting a very long time because the Russian authorities who occupied most of Czechoslovakia, Americans were up to Pilsen, only a little bit of it, they made sure they wanted to impose in the important seats their own men, so they kept us and kept us and kept us. When we arrived home, we were really all hoping to be the members of the new Czechoslovak Air Force, because we had a lot of experience, but we found a lot of opposition. And that's when I decided there will be no second escape, I'm going back. So I have exercised the privilege, which I found out from our Air Vice Marshal, who in the end ended up in prison himself over there. I was told, since you have joined the Royal Air Force from United Kingdom, you have the right to be demobilized in United Kingdom. So if you want my advice, get into the American zone, ask the Yanks to fly you to Bovington, get back to RAF Cosford, and to be demobilized. And this is exactly what I did.
The situation, I take it, then became very clear very quickly on your return.
Very quickly. In 1945, I already knew it was a matter of time before the communist regime will take over. And it was in 1948, but I wasn't going to be prepared. Like a lot of my unfortunate friends who really couldn't believe that they would be treated virtually as enemies. And they stayed in the Air Force, and gradually, by 48, they were kicked out, degraded, and some of them finished up in, you know, in labor barns, and some of them were locked up. My pilot escaped. Other member of 68 Squadron, he pinched an aeroplane while he was still flying. While he was still allowed to fly, he pinched an aeroplane with his navigator and the family, and they crash-landed it on the beach, I think in France. He couldn't go any further, and Max Etkin arranged very quickly. He was very helpful. He then became an MP for Holborn. He was extremely helpful to all the ex-members. So about 100 of us came back and rejoined the Air Force after the war, because we were asked if we would like to come back during the Cold War. But those who stayed behind, they had a rotten life.
Was part of the Air Force from Czechsud flown with the Russians? With some of the
there was a squadron formed as late as 1944. God knows why, but it was formed on the Russian front. And some of the pilots from England who were in the Royal Air Force volunteered to go there. And they thought that when they came back from the other side into liberated Czechoslovakia, that they would be treated better because they fought on both sides with the British and the Russians. No. Once they found out they were once serving in the Royal Air Force and swore allegiance to the British monarch, they were classified as traitors. So it was odd. A friend of mine who was a pilot, he volunteered to go to the Russian front to fly a Czech squadron with the Russian Air Force. When he was finally arrested, he was in a cell with a German Nazi, and he said, "What are you doing here? You fought against us, you won the war. I was the enemy, I'm locked up here." And that was horrific. The film, The Dark Blue World, explains it extremely well, the situation.
So what about yourself? You demobilized?
I came to England. I demobbed. I didn't know what I was going to do. I think I went into stamp business, try to go into surface. My two cousins who were in America, in the United States, they were successful in postage stamp business, you know. But then I had a letter from the Air Ministry say, would you be interested to come back into the Royal Air Force? That's why I jumped at it, because that's the only job I really could do. I finished my studies here. There was several professors in England who gave us the chance to finish our matriculation. But I had no real job except flying. So when they invited me to come back, I rejoined the Royal Air Force.
And what was the reason for the invite? She said the Cold War.
Yeah. They said we want ready, experienced crews which are still probably retained the ability. I was still on mosquitoes at RF Tangmere. They still had mosquitoes before we changed to the NF-11s. We sold the mosquitoes to Marshal Tito, but without the radar.
So you went back about 1950?
Yeah, about 1950. So I had... Yes, I had about... I didn't get demobbed until virtually the beginning of 46. It took a long time. So I had a few years as a civilian. I lived in London. And then tried my luck in printing, you know, ordinary letterpress printing. I thought I was interested in artistic things. But I was not a born businessman. So when the invitation came and a lot of my other friends rejoined, I jumped at it. I went back. They gave me my rank back. I think I went back as a... I had to go back as a pilot officer, but I soon became a flying officer and then later flight attendant. It was not the same after the war. You know, it was quite different. I was on the squadron. We had NF-11s. We were participating in the coronation flight paths. We were still doing interceptions. We were still practicing the same thing. And somehow there wasn't the spirit there, because really, as yet, there was no enemy, but there were potential enemy.
So who would that potential enemy have been? Would you?
The Soviet Union.
So you were practicing to intercept potentially Soviet aircraft, would you think?
And my country as well, who became member of the Warsaw Pact. It was very odd when I was able to return after 43 years to my native land in 1990. I was speaking to a Czech pilot who was showing me a MiG. And he said, what were you flying? I said, well, I finished up on Phantoms. He said, well, do you know something? This is very odd. I was on these MiGs, and I was flying very close to the Iron Curtain. So was I in Wien in Germany. He said, whenever I saw an American aircraft, I imagined it was an American pilot. He said, whenever I saw a Russian aircraft, I always thought it was a Russian pilot. But in both of those aircrafts, there were Czechs against each other. So I was branded, I was, you know, declared as a traitor. I couldn't return home for 43 years. Even then I didn't trust it. And so...
So the communist states had kept tracks on you as you go
The communists, the oh, they kept tracks on me even when I was in the Royal Air Force, yes. I kept getting messages to my former residence when I lived in London. And they said, you ought to come to the Czech embassy. And since you become a British subject in 1947, you ought to make up your mind what you want to be. I said, I have no shame that I have two nationalities. I've done nothing wrong. I have helped to liberate my country. I'm not going. And I knew if I entered the Czech embassy, I'll never come out alive. So I didn't. But the British intelligence was very clever. In the 50s, there was a Canberra which crashed. And in that Canberra, there was a pilot and a navigator, J. Pemberton. I knew him, James Pemberton. And the intelligence branch contacted me at RF Stradishaw, which is now in prison, said, we've got a chance to get you off the hook and to get you wiped out from the Czech intelligence, because we released the fact that it was you. And from then on, I had no more problems. And when the liberation came in 1989, and I went to the Czech embassy for the first time in London. And I said, well, my name is Nigel John Pemberton. He said, no, you died in 1954. I said, I didn't. It was very good fun. I had good fun with him.
So, with 29 Squadron, you say that was still back with the Mosquitoes, was it?
29 Mosquitoes, right up to 51, and then we had the NF-11, the Meteor NF-11, long-nose Meteor.
What was that like as an aircraft?
Very good. Gentleman's aircraft. Forgave you for any mistake you made. Absolutely superb. Very comfortable. Very good. The only thing I could not get used to, the shortage of fuel. No sooner you got airborne, you had to worry about getting back, you know, but in a piston aircraft, it didn't matter. Terrible. That was a psychological adjustment, which I find extremely difficult. You got airborne, 40 minutes interceptions, and after that, start looking to get back.
What improvements have there been in the radar?
None. It was still Mark 10, the very same radar which I used in the Mosquito when the war ended. And it wasn't until, I think, 1954, when they brought the Mark 21 radar. That was a big improvement. So there was nothing happened. Well, you know, there was no money for any development.
So for that period, for that 10-year period, really, after the war, there was no...
No, there was still Mark 10. You know, coming back into the Mosquito, into RAF Tangmere, I didn't even feel I left the Air Force. It was just the same.
Was there any changes in tactics at all?
That's when they were using all these interception tech, very, very sophisticated. And in school, they had a 238 OCU at Colerne, where there was a night fighter OCU. They were very keen on teaching people interception procedures rather than chasing aircraft. It was put down as the post-war training, and they had a proper course. In fact, I landed there as an instructor for a bit of a rest, so that was quite interesting when I compared it to the beginning of night fighting.
Can you run through those interception procedures as you had done at that time?
Yes, well, the interceptions were, we practiced them on a simulator, and they were mainly the interceptions of different angles. There was the 90 degree interception, 45 degree interception, or 180 degree head-on interception. Both of those could be governed and controlled by the accurate point of turning the aircraft either around according to the range where the blip or the echo appeared. So the important training was for the navigator or the radar navigator to know the exact spot at which to commence the turn. And that was quite well practiced on the simulator, so we didn't have to have aircraft. But we did have brigands, Bristol brigands, where we had three students, a pilot and an instructor. And we were doing the same thing as we did. We had a target, and the pilots split up, and they set up different interceptions, head-on or 90 degree, and we were training the students. Don't tell me about that. We had students from Syria, from Israel, from somewhere else, and they argued because they had to, the governments paid for their training, and that was a dreadful course, that course, and we had all these people on there.
In 54, you joined 125 Squadron?
Yeah, 125.
What was the operating at the time?
Venoms. I didn't like them. It was the conversion from Vampire. Again, it was Mark 21 radar, one engine. I never flew on one engine. I didn't like that at all. Very maneuverable, very, very good for the job, but, you know, psychologically, somebody who's been flying with two engines, you felt always very unsafe. And then later, well, they operated Venoms for some time. The successor of the Venom would then be a Javelin, Gloster Javelin. That was short-lived, because that was not very maneuverable. And so that was about as much as they used to call it all-weather squadrons. The only I think the only true all-weather aircraft would be the Challenger first. The Venom was still basically a converted day fighter into a night fighter. We were doing GCA approaches, ground control approach, so we could land in fairly bad weather. And I had been invited to do a ground job. So